Hello and welcome to the Manchester is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Rilston. I'm your host today, recording on a Friday morning before Eric Ten Hag's press conference later this afternoon. So if you're watching on a YouTube platform, you'll see Samuel's dressed very smartly. Samuel, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Not bad at all.
We're just in each other's presence a few hours ago, weren't we? Wasn't too long ago.
It wasn't. No, it wasn't. So yeah, it's always nice to see you again, of course.
Can't get away from us at the moment. I'm not sure I can take four pints of Guinness on a weeknight now. It's a young man's game. Anyway, Samuel, we'll look at some housekeeping bits today, some transfer bits in the first part. We're just going to do two parts because we've not had a game during the week. And then later in the podcast, we'll look ahead to the Everton game. Obviously, United have the early kickoff against the Toffees on Saturday afternoon, tomorrow at Old Trafford. We'll just begin with by discussing Kobbie Mainoo. I wrote the line this week that the club have opened talks over a new deal. He only signed a new contract last year. But since then, Samuel has obviously broken into the first team, showed excellent progression. We've talked about him and praised him at length on this podcast. I think there's no rush to do the deal. That's the way it was described to me, because the performance-related bonuses in his current contract have been triggered, so he's still earning an all right wage. But it just shows, doesn't it, Samuel, how it highlights, anyways, his progression, because he's really been fantastic. And at the moment, he's 18 years old, but he's one of the first teams on the team sheet.
Well, he's certainly deserving of a contract that's reflective of his status at the moment and the progress he's made. He's done terrifically since he came into the team in November. And although he got that contract, would it have been last year? I think it was.
Yeah,
he sat down. Then it's completely logical to sit him down again. I think they did it with Scott McTominay. I mean, McTominay had this period where he signed, it felt like, about three contracts within an 18-month period during his first years in the senior squad. So if he's to be rewarded as he was back then, some of those contracts at the time were a little bit mystifying, frankly. But in the case of Mainoo, he is absolutely integral to United going forward. And they when he was taken out of the team against Forest last week, it was a bold call by Ten Hag, because you thought if Mainoo doesn't play well, United don't play well. And he didn't have a good game against Fulham. It was probably the one time where you've come away from game and thought he wasn't really at it today. And it's not a coincidence that United weren't at it that day either. So, as I said quite recently, I think the most important signing they make in the summer will be the midfielder to supplement Mainoo. It will be fascinating to see who they bring in there. And I've no idea who that will be. I wouldn't even want to even make a recommendation for that position. I think it's going to require a lot of fastidious scouting and a very thorough process in terms of the due diligence and settling on a player who's going to be attainable, who's going to be the right supplement for Mainoo. Because although Casemiro's had a poor season, his presence in the team has helped Mainoo undeniably, and having that, you know, master and apprentice dynamic in there, it's not been all bad. I mean, United until recently, they were, you know, winning most of their games, and they've had a couple of setbacks, and I think nobody really expected them to get anything at City, but Fulham was a real bad one. But I thought by and large at City, Casemiro and Mainoo did quite well. And it was an interesting dynamic of that day, because I think Mainoo deliberately played within himself because he realised he couldn't quite be as advanced, he couldn't quite be as embrace carpe diem football, because you're coming up against the best team in the world and you've got to be a lot more disciplined. So that day he seemed to not add a string to his bow, because everyone knew he was capable of it. But it was another away day where he actually, despite the final score, I thought he excelled, and it was another test that he passed. And that's the quirk about his form. It's that his best performances, his most impressive performances, are coming away from Old Trafford. And so it does raise, you know, the tantalising prospect of how good he will be or could be when he does start to hit his stride in home games.
Well, I was told that the direct quote was that he loves to play with Casemiro. As you say, obviously Casemiro might be leaving the club in the summer. And we were talking last night, actually. I think I suggested, could you imagine Declan Rice in that midfield with Mainoo and Fernandes? That would be a brilliant free, and a title challenging free, I'd suggest as well. But I think he's more of an eight, isn't he? He's a blend of a six and an eight. Mainoo, I think he's wasted his just playing in a six position. He's not going to be that sole defensive midfielder. He can get the ball forward and play fantastic progressive passes, and he's really useful in that role. We'll move on then, Samuel. Omar Berada, you wrote the line on, was it Tuesday, that he's holding secret meetings Sounds very exciting. Is it exciting?
It might be or it might not be. I'm certainly not privy to these meetings. Someone suggested that he's held some meetings in his garden, but I suspect they were joking on that count, on that part. I don't think that as nice as the weather has been this week, it's still not been nice enough to be, you know, going out into your garden unless you're unless you're under house arrest. Unfortunately, he's not in those circumstances at Manchester City, but he's free to conduct himself how he chooses fit. He's not officially representing Manchester United because he's still technically an employee of Manchester City and he's serving out that period of gardening leave. But as Jim Ratcliffe told us a couple of weeks ago, City were very grown up about the discussions and the disappointment that they had in Berardi going. They were understanding of it. He contrasted that with how Newcastle have reacted to United wanting Dan Ashworth. And I don't think anybody's really got a problem with it. I don't think City are going to kick up a fuss, and they haven't kicked up a fuss. I mean, it was reported last week that Berardi was had held meetings with the staff at United. My line was slightly different. I was told that he'd been holding external meetings and maintaining contact, maintaining relationships. Who, of course, you know, why wouldn't you want to do that? You're moving. I mean, he's moving to a bigger job, really. I mean, it might be, as far as City are concerned, they're the better football team, they're the better run club, of course, but going to Manchester United and the responsibilities that that will entail of being chief executive and also the how empowered he's going to be in that role. I mean, Ratcliffe has already said that he's going to have a say in what style they eventually settle on. So it's, you know, it's a hell of a job, and you want to hit the ground running. And it would have been a bit odd if he was just, you know, sitting in his garden, cutting the lawn on a dry day. But I suspect if in his substantially sized garden, he's got a gardener who does that for him anyway.
Well, from one garden to another, because spring is around the corner, Samuel. The light and night are about to come at the end of the month, and flowers will start to bloom. So we'll move on to Dan Ashworth's garden. I guess there's been no real movement or no significant updates anyway since the last few weeks. He's obviously been placed on gardening leave by Newcastle, and he is set to be appointed as United's inaugural sporting director. How long do we anticipate this goes on for? Because it's within everyone's best interests for surely Dan Ashworth to get on board sooner rather than later. And Newcastle are also in the position where they might drag the heels in negotiations, but surely they would like to receive a fee for Dan Ashworth to help out their FFP and profit and sustainability gripes and concerns.
I honestly have no idea how long that process will take. I think that given that he's already on gardening leave and a fee hasn't been agreed between the clubs, and when he agreed to go to Newcastle, that was in the February of 2022, and he didn't start until I think the July it might have been. So that's, I think, just going off that time frame already, I think United will do well to get him in working for them officially this calendar year. And of course, Newcastle drag their heels into it, and they're not short of cheerleaders up there who will do their bidding and, you know, suggest that it is actually credible to be demanding £15 million or £20 million, but they're not going to get that. I mean, United have suggested that they won't get £10 million. It's preposterous. I'm not even sure it's legally doable to hold out for that amount of money. It's, you know, with other people in workplaces that is so far removed from football clubs, you've not got the legal clout to challenge an employer if they say, well, you're going on gardening leave for 2 years. A family friend had that. They were told that they couldn't work for 2 years. They were put on 2 years of gardening leave, and they didn't have the stomach to actually contest it, which was pretty absurd, because you should be able to, and it's not legally sound. And that's what Ratcliffe was getting at. It just, he used the word silly, stupid and absurd. And there's obviously this forced rivalry that some, not you of course, but some up at Newcastle try still give the illusion that exists between Manchester United and Newcastle, because Newcastle finished second to them a couple of times in the 90s. And clearly they're affronted that one of their biggest assets is in the process of going to United effectively. But you've got, as Ratcliffe said, you've got to be grown up about it. I mean, if United were in that position now, and it's not happened for a while where Real Madrid have come and wanted one of their players, because why would they by and large? But United, there's no need for hissy fits over it. I mean, eventually United just relented when Cristiano Ronaldo went to Real Madrid because they knew that he wanted to go to Real Madrid. Sometimes you get lucky. There's a fax machine malfunction and you get to keep David De Gea for another 8 years, which, you know, was great for United. And I don't think anybody would have predicted that in that summer of 2015 when it did seem like he was destined to join Real Madrid. So sometimes digging your heels in, it can work in your favour, but that was certainly more by luck than judgment where United were concerned. If anything, that was descending into a bit of a disaster class because the replacements they were lining up for De Gea. I mean, Keylor Navas didn't want to go as part of the swap deal, but Jasper Cillessen was being quite credibly touted at the time. And again, Dutch manager, Dutch player, not a lot has changed in some
before.
Cases. Yes, we have. But this is, it's a different matter. But I think it was obvious that Ineos and Ratcliffe were going to want someone high profile, and the Ratcliffe news had been doing the rounds. We obviously did the line, I think, back in December or November about the interest there, and they're always going to bring in a replacement for John Murta. And logically, people, even at the time before it was an established fact of their interest, you put two and two together with Ashworth, knowing Dave Brailsford for a number of years and the progression Ashworth has made in his career as well. I think he seems to have continuously gone to bigger clubs, having been at West Brom, going to Brighton at the time. They were in a better place than West Brom, I'd have argued, in 2018. They just got promoted to the Premier League. You go to Newcastle United, who are a much bigger club than a lot of people would give them credit for. I think you have sometimes, I know it's a cliche, but I think some people do actually have to go to St James's Park and take in a game and really appreciate
being a one city club, though, isn't it? I mean, that's the gates and the crowds, that obviously helps. I mean, there's 52,000 there every week, but in Manchester, in different cities, they are multiple clubs, obviously. And then the Northeast, Newcastle are the biggest club in the Northeast, I guess. So, I mean, there's always a comparison made to a goldfish bowl, and I think it can sometimes be a bit harsh, but I think there is an element of that in the Northeast sometimes.
I love going to St James's Park. It's there's a real warmth about it. When you're walking around that stadium, I think the fact that it is a little bit dated, it adds to the charm. And I know that sounds a bit hypocritical because we go to Old Trafford and we're looking at it and thinking how dated it is and aged it is, but it's, you know, we go there all the time. I think sometimes when you go to a club that, you know, with all due respect to Newcastle, they haven't won a major trophy since 1969, and it's ridiculous that they've not won an FA Cup since 1955 when you look at some of the clubs who've won the FA Cup, and then you see the stadium and I always get a pang of nostalgia walking past the steps where Kevin Keegan came out and addressed the fans after they sold Andy Cole, because those are the steps that United's players walk up now when they arrive at the stadium. It's the players' entrance, and you've got the Sir Bobby Robson statue, the Jackie Milburn statue, obviously Shearer's Bar is nearby. Just the words Gallagher. I think the football romantic in me, I can't get enough of it. And the chaps in the press room are lovely, and it's a nice press lounge as well. And it's also a great press box. It's a privileged position to be right behind the dugouts there. It's great for colour. So I think I've done enough here in covering my little bit of fondness for Newcastle without trying to, whilst also saying that, agreeing with Ratcliffe that it is absurd, ridiculous and stupid what they're doing. But the dilemma, I suppose, for United, although it will help Ineos's narrative if they don't get off the right foot next season, is that in terms of the recruitment for the summer, the man leading that still is John Murta. So if they're looking at it quite selfishly, if it doesn't work out next season, even though it will be their money they're spending, they can always say, well, look at the position we were in. We wanted Dan Ashworth. We couldn't get him in. And John Murta was still leading recruitment. But I still don't think that they would get much of a pass for that, because you've got Dave Brailsford overseeing all this. And they're going to be judged on what happens in the summer more than John Murta, and rightly so.
Do you think those comments from Ratcliffe could potentially be detrimental in negotiations for Ashworth? I mean, could they potentially rub people in Newcastle up the wrong way and maybe strengthen their position in the negotiations?
I don't think so, just because of the legal side of it. You look at how much they paid Brighton, and what was it? Was it about 2.5 million or
around that? I think 5 million.
In the end. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, so, you know, that I think at the time you'd think, look at that and think, you know, Brighton did well to get £5 million for a sporting director who's clearly worth his salt. But the talk of three or four times that figure is preposterous. And I'm sure Newcastle will get more than £5 million, and rightly so. But this is a guy who did only just move clubs for that figure less than 2 years ago. I think it was that they settled on the £5 million, Brighton and Newcastle. And as good as Newcastle have been in the intervening period, in the interim, you're not going to get I think you'd do well to get just an eight-figure fee, but you're not going to get a figure well into eight figures, like 15 million or 20 million. It is ridiculous.
It's crazy that we've got to the point in football in 2024 that sporting directors have such high profiles as and almost identical profiles to players in terms of how big they are, known they are, and moving for such big sums as well. If you told someone in the early 2000s that a sporting director would potentially move clubs for 10 million, they'd think they'd be pretty gobsmacked. But that's the way it's gone, hasn't it, with the money in the game. We'll talk briefly about Trino.
In the early 2000s, the prospect of someone moving for £100 million seemed fanciful back then. At the time, it was a watershed moment. I think when Zidane moved for £50 million in 2001, I think he moved to Real Madrid. So yeah, I mean, it's actually quite reassuring.
We've probably reached our ceiling now, haven't we? I mean, you see the Coutinho move to Barcelona a couple of years ago. You kind of think it can't go any higher than it has, surely not.
And the FFP rules help as well, of course. Yeah.
Although I do think there will be changes to those rules eventually, actually, because it's starting to kind of Aston Villa and Newcastle, for example, clubs.
Oh, they are flawed.
Europe. They're very hamstrung, those clubs at the moment. Training on Wednesday, Rashford was back. We'll touch a bit on that in the second part. But I just wanted to touch on youngsters coming into training against Samuel. I mean, there's been various youngsters spotted in first team training this season and last season. And I was probably a bit harsh on Erik ten Hag when we discussed Kobbie Mounoù on the last podcast. But because he does deserve credit. There's been a lot of youngsters involved in training. A lot of the times they're obviously just added and promoted to senior sessions to make up numbers, but nonetheless it's excellent experience for them. I think it was 8 youngsters in training on Wednesday or something like that anyways, but it's an excellent opportunity. And we've talked about Darren Fletcher there as the technical director recently, and I think he plays a key role, doesn't he, in bringing those lads up. He kind of works with Travis Binion and Mitchell van der Gaag, and that's how it works, and they promote the lads into first team sessions.
Yeah, the layout the offices, the coaches' offices in Carrington is, it might not be fascinating for too many people, but having, you know, had the privilege of seeing that part of the building, you've got the manager's office, and it's adjoined to the coach's office next door, and they've even got a Sabutio table out there to, you know, have a play around with tactics rather than just doing it on a tactics board. And so if Ten Hag gets his injury bulletin that morning from Gary O'Driscoll, he just walks through a door, says to Mitchell van der Gaag, Darren Fletcher, like, you know, we need a player in this position, that position, the other position for training today. Van der Gaag will then speak to Darren Fletcher, who's, you know, within earshot pretty much. And Fletcher will know immediately who to call over from the academy building. And of course, there've been a lot recently because United have had, I think they had 10 players missing through injury at City last week. The unconfirmed injury, or the unreported injury, I should say, was Tom Heaton, who's missed a few games. But the MEN, being the eagle-eyed correspondents that we are, we noticed a few weeks ago that Dermot Mee has been involved in the pre-match warm-ups, and that means that Tom Heaton's not there, and that would logically mean he's injured. But he only had a niggle, and he's due to be back in full training next week. But that, look, I'll be honest, there have been some players who've got the call up over the last few days who I hadn't heard of before, or player anyway. I mean, Harry Amass, Charlie McNeil, Louis Jackson, Maxi Oyedele is back. I mean, his loan move has effectively ended already at Forest Green Rovers.
They were asking for trouble sending them there, really. I mean, Troy Deeney was manager. It was a
Troy Deeney. Troy Deeney was. Yeah, Troy Deeney was the manager when he signed, and then Troy Deeney was rather predictably sacked quite swiftly. I'm not too sure he's cut out for management. And you know, I think Dan Gore, although he's been injured recently, Port Vale have had a managerial change since he made his loan move. And sometimes that can work in the player's favour. Ahmad moved to Sunderland last year when Alex Neil was the manager. He left before the end of August for Stoke, I think it was. Tony Mowbray came in, and it was under Tony Mowbray that he flourished. He was brilliant under Mowbray. And Mowbray's got, he's probably got an underrated reputation for playing good attacking football, certainly at Championship level. He did it with West Brom, he did it with Blackburn, and he's certainly a more logical appointment at that level for Birmingham City than Wayne Rooney was. But going back to the young lads who've been in training this week, I think there was one lad who I literally had not heard of before called Bendito Mantato, who's only 16. So that was, yeah, that was an eye-opener. And of course, Habib Ogunei, I think is the pronunciation of his name. He's been on the bench a couple of times recently. Toby Collier is a much easier pronunciation. But Harry Amas has been in training a few times recently. I think there were some fans speculating whether he would be in the squad at Villa because Luke Shaw was a doubt going into that match, and United haven't got a left back at the moment. And of course, Sergio Reguilón's done an interview this week, and he's not bitter about the fact that the his loan was terminated at the halfway point. He sounds quite fond of United and the fleeting experience that he had at the club. But it is getting to a point now where I just think, for the purposes of balance and fairness, that if you've not got a senior left back available, you might as well have a left back on the bench, however callow he is. And look, they see these young lads up close. Every day they assess them very, very minutely. They will have a much better idea of whether they're remotely close or ready for the level of being considered to be in a Premier League match day squad. That said, as Toby Collier and Habib Ogunei, not looking to discredit them at all whatsoever, but there is definitely an element of making up the numbers because so many senior players are out injured. They've got four or five senior players out on loan. You look at Alvaro Fernandez's situation, and I mean, Ten Hag clearly just doesn't really rate him. Otherwise, he'd have used him by now. But it would have made a lot more sense to have retained him or recalled him and had him about in the squad. And unfortunately for United, they can't do that. But then again, he's getting reasonable game time at Benfica. And I think that his move there will be made permanent if he plays a certain number of games. So it's about weighing it up. I mean, it could have gone one way for him, it could have gone the other. It's strange to think with Fernandez, Alvaro Fernandez, that is, that he was certainly in training quite prominently 2 years ago under Ralf Rangnick, and he was in a couple of matchday squads, but he has literally never played for the first team, and he probably never will play for the first team.
I've made this point a few times. He should have made his debut against Crystal Palace on the final day of that season, and when Alex Taylor started, and I thought that was silly.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And it was a surprise that he wasn't included in Ten Hag's first tour squad. And I think he might have posted something at the time that hinted at his unhappiness about that. He did quite well at Preston last season, but he's just not had a look in. And I think as long as Ten Hag is at United, he won't have a look in. And of course, where there's the possibility of him moving to Benfica permanently, is he of consideration? Probably not. I don't think Sam Murray, who was the left back when they won the Youth Cup a couple of years ago, I'm not sure he can technically even play for United in the first team because he's registered on loan at Rochdale, even though I'm not sure he's ever actually trained with his Rochdale teammates because of this kind of like work experience loan arrangement they've got, where the player will train a lot with United, but he will be made available for certain games with Rochdale. Sam Mather made his debut for Rochdale in the week, having trained quite a lot with United first team recently, but the time came, it would have been what, 4 or 5 weeks into his loan, he finally, got the call to go over to Rochdale, having spent probably 4 weeks training with the first team back at Carrington. So, I mean, Ten Hag's press conference is in exactly 2 hours now. If Johnny Evans is injured and if nobody is coming back, then it's going to be a new youngster in the squad. And I hope it's a new youngster in the squad rather than this nonsense of putting two goalkeepers on the bench, because, Ten Hag has done that a needless amount of times. You'd much rather give... How beneficial is it for a young lad, teenage lad, even if they don't play, just to sit on the bench for a match day at Old Trafford where you've got 70,000 fans in the stands and there's a lot riding on the game? Like, that's an invaluable experience. Gary Neville said, you're travelling to Istanbul with the team in 1993. I think he might have actually come on late on in that one, but he learned more from that experience than he did playing for the reserves in their games at the Cliff or wherever it was.
Well, you just soak it all up, don't you? I imagine if you're a young player in that scenario and you just look around and how players carry themselves, how they're prepared.
Look and learn, yeah.
Exactly. Going back to Harry Amas briefly, I mean, there's been a lot of suggestions that he could make a squad. I mean, he's still only 16. He's obviously a really bright talent. He's been fantastic for the under-18s this season. But he's still not made his debut for the under-21s. I think physically, his stature as well, I think another season academy football, and then maybe we'll push on into the senior team. But for now, those shouts are a bit premature, I'd say. Some of you wanted to mention the Mourinho documentary just before we finish this part. I've not actually had a chance to read your article properly, but do you want to expand on that?
Well, he mentioned it to Italian journalists in January that he had a Netflix documentary coming out. That will be coming out in January of 2025. A four-part Netflix series on Jose Mourinho's career in football, in management. So you've got a wealth of material to get stuck into there. And that obviously raises the tantalising prospect of him shedding even more light on his time at his 2.5 years at United. I don't know if we touched upon it, but the Beckham documentary, I wasn't particularly impressed by. I mean, it was very, very... The guy they got to do it clearly didn't know his subject matter, and there were so many misleading narratives and the way it was edited.
That was deliberate, though, was it not? I mean, it was...
Yeah, it was. It was.
There was a lot of inaccuracies, but on purpose to make Beckham look a bit better.
And to over-dramatise it, but I've not watched it, but I think with the... was it the F1 Drive to Survive? I think the sound syncing in that, they would overlap some commentaries with that weren't said at this time, yet they're given the illusion that it was said at this time in a race. Yeah. And I don't know why they feel the need to do that, because if you're just authentic, it's probably more interesting. And the Beckham one obviously got a hell of a lot of traction because he's been one of the most recognisable sports persons of the last 30 years, and he still has that aura about him, and people are still starstruck when they see him, and people have different connections to him. And I remember as a kid watching a documentary around Beckham that was just, it was an in-house production by United. It was one of their documentary videos, and it was far more insightful than the Netflix one. And this was just following David Beckham when he was a 21-year-old going on 22. He just started dating Victoria Adams, as she was known back then. So and they had really enviable access to him, like going around his house. It was Rob McCaffrey who did it, who was a really, really good sports presenter back in the 90s and the 2000s. And that was just seeing Beckham in that environment at home with his mum and dad, with his sister as well. I mean, he's a very, very different, his image now is completely different back then to back then. And I remember getting his autograph when I was a kid, and he was absolutely amazing with fans. And I did a piece on the back of the Netflix series just contrasting how different a person he is, but there were still peak times when people have an experience with him. And that lovely, charming lad who isn't thinking about PR emerges, but he's become so PR massaged that there are times when you look at him and he's just not, it's inauthentic. And it's a shame because, as I said, I think in certain environments...
Were you talking about Marcus Rashford there, or were you talking about Beckham on that last part?
No. I'm not making any comparisons at all. I wasn't even thinking about Marcus Rashford there. No, I was just making the fair contrast. But that piece has been up since October. So if anyone wants to seek it out, they're more than welcome to. I think with Mourinho, that is not a man who is PR massaged. That is a man who is authentic, who, although he has had the odd PR advisor pointing him in the right direction, maybe when he speaks, I don't think anyone's thinking, well, this guy is, you know, is inauthentic, or you can't believe him. There's always been something compelling about Mourinho since he hit the mainstream in 2003 when Porto won the UEFA Cup. And it's been an extraordinary career. So, I mean, just even the time at Real Madrid, I remember those four games against Barcelona within 18 days in 2011, which were just, you know, it was carnage, playing them in the league, playing them in the Copa del Rey final, and then the two-legged Champions League semi-final. And it was kicking off left, right and centre, and it continued to kick off going into the next season. He's just a compelling figure in football, and he still is. So that will certainly, I think I was ordered to restart our Netflix subscription after the Beckham documentary came out, ironically, but I think we've still got it. So I think we'll certainly be retaining it until the new year.
He's got bags of charisma, doesn't he, Mourinho? So it should be a very good watch. We'll be back in a month for part two. That's it for part one. Welcome back to part two of the Manchester is Red podcast. Now, Samuel, will really fly through this section because I know you need to leave to Carrington in 15 minutes time or so. But obviously Everton tomorrow afternoon, early kickoff, 12:30. I feel like these are the games, I've made this point a few times, that United kind of struggling. Early kickoffs, the crowd maybe isn't going and the atmosphere isn't as good as it can be on evening games. And it's against their side who are going to sit deep, play a low block. And United have the challenge, obviously, tomorrow of breaking them down. And their build-up play, I think it gets exposed in scenarios like that. Obviously, no Martinez, who's usually huge. What are you expecting? Because it's a hugely important game when you look at the Premier League table. I mean, 11 points behind Aston Villa. They really need a win. They can't slip up and afford the drop points.
I think it would probably help United if Everton go 1-0 up early on, or like Nottingham Forest go 2-0 up with inside the first 3 minutes, because there was some alacrity about them against Forest back in August. And you always had the belief, even though it was a pretty dire situation to be in at the start, you always had the belief that the situation was salvageable. And of course, they salvaged it, they clawed it back. And it really wasn't a surprise that they won that game 3-2. But as you said, you look at the other, I mean, they've had 16 defeats this season. I think they've lost 8 times at Old Trafford, haven't they? And against Fulham, the other week, they didn't get going until well into the second half. Their best period in that game was between the equaliser in the 89th minute and Alex Iwobi's winner in the 95th minute. And that just shows you that if time is of the essence, and you know, they've got to do something quite immediately, then they can get going and they can play at a certain tempo that, you know, that opponents can be overwhelmed by. It didn't happen with Fulham that day, but there was a lot to get behind with the intent they showed between Maguire scoring and Iwobi getting that winner. But I looked at Everton's, I think they've had 3 Premier League away games this calendar year, and their possession stats in those games range from 27% to 35%. So I think it's safe to assume that United will have a measure of control against Everton. I think Fulham were a bit cannier when they went to Old Trafford a couple of weeks ago, in that although United had more of the ball, they weren't harming Fulham when they did have the ball. During that, the first 70 minutes, I'd say. I think Calvin Bassey scored in it was just gone the hour mark. And so there's a way of dealing with United, but Everton also, they're profligate, as United discovered at Goodison Park in November. That was a very unusual first half, that United were 1-0 up without creating a chance because of the extraordinary overhead kick that Garnacho scored. They didn't create another chance in that half. it was a uncharacteristically clinical performance from them that day. But Everton had a bucket load of chances before half time, and United managed the game very well in the second half. And in the end, it was a very good and I suppose surprisingly comfortable 3-0 win. With tomorrow's game, look, I mean, Dyche has to decide whether to go with Beto up front again or whether he brings Calvert-Lewin back in. I think Doucouré is back in the fold now for Everton, which is a big boost for them because he's one of their most important players. And although he can be quite erratic on the ball, he also is a vital goal scorer. He scored their most important goal last season. And I still think that even when you look at Everton's team, there are some really quite good, you know, pretty good, certainly Premier League standard individuals there. And look, they're on a bad run at the moment. I don't think they've actually won in their last, must be 6 or 7 games. And you know, they're certainly not out of the woods as far as relegation is concerned. It's helped with them having 4 more points put onto their tally after that appeal over the 10-point deduction. But this is a game that United dominated last season. You're coming away from it thinking, well, if there's one criticism of them, it's that they've only won 2-0 because they were excellent, especially in the first half last season. They were so dominant. It was one-way traffic. I think it might have been one of those games where Fernandes started in central midfield, and he was excellent in that role last season. There's been a case certainly at times watching United this season where you've wondered, well, is it worth dropping Fernandes back there to see whether he can underpin attacks as well as he did during his stint there last season? But it's a different United nearly 12 months on in this game. And look, I think the Luton game, when they won that in November, they should have scored early, and it wasn't panic stations that day. When the goal did come, it was an element of finally, and it was on the hour mark, so it was one of those rare wins which actually wasn't procured by a goal in the 80-something minute or in added time. So really, the onus is on United to have a fast start. It's an obvious thing to say, but if they score early on, then you think, well, they're all right. But if the game goes, the longer the game goes on, if it's goalless, then you start to wonder what United are going to do, because they're not going to have a focal point unless Rasmus Højlund is available. And look, technically, he could be. He was ruled out for between 2 and 3 weeks 2 weeks ago. So again, we've not had the team news yet. He's got the Player of the Month award for February, and rightly so. I think even when he didn't play last month against Fulham, that was even more of a case to give him the award, because everyone saw just how important he is to United. And I suppose the balancing act they've got to decide there is, do you risk him for this game, or do you make absolutely certain that he is fit for Liverpool next week? Because as vital as the Premier League is, we both know which is the bigger game out of these two coming up.
I listened to Dyche's press conference yesterday, and he kind of reiterated the point a few times about their underlying numbers. And I know you're not a statistic man, really, Samuel, but Dave Hughes, who works at Everton, of course, in media, he was big into his XG, expected goals, etc. But I really, they're actually performing quite well on their underlying numbers and in attacking and defensive scenarios. So I think people at Everton feel they should be higher in the table. Obviously, they've had the points deduction. So I mean, I don't think they're going to go down. I think they're in safe hands with Dyche and the game.
I saw this.
The game suits them.
Frankly, I've got to say, I saw this bollocks in a piece about Chelsea recently, where someone said, "Oh, the people at Chelsea feel their underlying numbers mean they should be higher in the table." No, you're 11.
Well, not with
reason.
Chelsea.
They've lost. You've lost 10 games. You spent more than £1 billion. You didn't have the bottle to get past a callow and depleted Liverpool team.
Well, do you know
this
me and
nonsense
Tyrone
about
will do an expected goal,
the alternative table of podcast. The alternative table? They've got to do these geeks and these nerds and these. These people, frankly, I mean, Mourinho was once called an enemy of football, but these
Samuel,
people
you're
are real enemies
me.
Of football.
You're talking about me. I am now an
well,
enemy of football.
I'm happy to. Yeah, I'm going to go with it. It's a matter of time until someone does. I mean, is there an XG table? And it's like, oh, Everton or Chelsea are in the Champions League place for the XG table. Well done. Well done for missing all those chances this season. But you just look at the attempts. Like, a relevant stat, and I like it, is how many times United have faced shots at their own goal this season.
But that is a relevant stat. The reason why XG is relevant, because if you look at shots on target, right, or shots on goal, it just gives you a number in terms of, right, United have had 5 shots on target. However, it doesn't actually tell you how good those chances are. Those chances, those shots could be from 30 yards. It could be Fernandes hitting speculative efforts. But XG indicates, okay, is that a better chance? Is it in the box? Is it close to the goal? Where was the goalkeeper standing? So it is actually a better indicator of shot probability and chances
of the ball going back in the net.
Well, I know you're doing it, and you're running late for your press conference anyways.
No. Really, do you know what? I think I'd be late for my press conference just to state the case against it. I remember that last season, was it after United drew 2-2 Arsenal, and you said, oh, United's XG was 0 point something. And I'm like, yeah, but they scored 2.0 goals if you want me to put the decimal point and the zero at the end of it.
Obviously,
I'm not having it.
If you perform like that across the season, you're not going to score 2 goals in each game. If you keep on doing that each game, you're not going to. The chances are you'll regress to the mean.
Well, they scored enough goals to finish third, so I think it was okay for them last season. Look, I'm no Luddite. I've got AirPods that I've managed to hook up with the Bluetooth on my laptop again today, but I'm never having XG. It's a load of nonsense. I remember it being flagged when City somehow lost 2-0 at Spurs 4 years ago, and I'm like, just, yeah, bore off. Just. That's a day where you've got the Steven Bergwijn debut goal and the roar of the crowd. That is football. That you know, look at the scenes at Wimbledon last week, added time goal against MK Dons.
But
football to me
is VAR, XG, expected goals. That's my kind of football, Samuel. I'm joking. team news, I mean, we don't exactly know what the latest team news is, as you say, because the press conference is coming up. But on the knowledge that we do have, I guess it would be Evans potentially out of the team and Amrabat in at left back and Lindelof moving to centre half on what we know at the moment.
Yeah, yeah. I've not done my panel team yet because I've got to wait for the team news. But it may be a homage to Rich, who's on holiday this week, and Rich sometimes just puts selections in where he's almost like playing to the gallery, or he doesn't really believe it, but it is a bit like that. But you know, we were on the same page the other week when we were, or was it last week, we were
Anthony
discussing Anthony at left back, yeah. And I'm not ruling it out. I refuse to rule it out. But people will, if people want to find out, I'm sure they'll go looking for the panel on.
See,
on
I'd
Saturday
argue
morning.
You're an enemy of football considering playing Ante at fullback. I do not want to see that on Saturday afternoon.
Look, I can't use the Argo quote every week, but there's a chance that it's another Argo situation that United are in, just because, look, probably for the rest of the season, or certainly the majority for the run-in, they're not going to have an out-and-out left-back. And I touched upon it earlier, but of course the decision to terminate Reguilón's loan, it doesn't look great. But when he gave that interview to Matt Dickinson in the Times, and he said that he cried after they lost 3-0, to Newcastle in November, he cried in the dressing room afterwards. I was thinking to myself, look, I'm actually happy to tolerate Lindelof or Amrabat left back over him, because that is not, I'm not sure that's Newcastle United material, never Man United material. It's absolutely risible. And I'm sure there's a demographic of fans out there who think, well, what's wrong with that? He's shown his emotion, and there's nothing wrong with showing your emotion when it's actually, you know,
Champions League final, high stakes, not the bloody early rounds of the Carabao Cup.
Exactly, exactly. Or just in everyday life over certain issues. You know, it's important, I'd actually stress, to show your emotions rather than bottle them up. But when you lose a League Cup game, I mean, Christ, what would he have been like when they lost 3-0 to Bournemouth at home in his last...
the last couple of minutes, you have just morphed slowly into Roy Keane. Your comments on XG, your comments on emotions and crying in the dressing room. Roy Keane wouldn't be having any of that nonsense, would he?
No, and he's back on Instagram as well, of course, which I think has cheered everyone. I think his collection of Instagram posts is probably I think everyone I've pretty much liked of them, because it's a great image, it's a great caption. You can't knock it. If like in this era of people refer to themselves as content creators, and you know, Keane was taking the mickey out of himself, wasn't he, a couple of years ago? You know, my team say I need to create some content, so here's some. So yeah, I can't deny that I've always liked the cut of Roy Keane's jib, and I can't quite understand anyone who wouldn't like the cut of Roy Keane's jib either.
Yeah, he's definitely the best pundit, 100%. He's very good value when he speaks. Thank you, Samuel.
Thank you, Stephen.
And thanks to listeners. As usual, enjoy the game on Saturday afternoon. We'll be back on Monday to review the match. Take care.